digital piracy. I'm Rob Atkinson, I'm president of ITIF, and we'll be joined by my colleague Daniel Castro, who is the lead author on the report, but I also want to thank Richard Bennett and Scott Andes, who are co-authors of the report and did excellent work on it. Most of you know Daniel. He is a senior analyst at ITIF, and before joining ITIF, he was a IT analyst at GAO, and where he worked on a lot of reports around government use of IT. He has a master's of science in information security technology and management from Carnegie Mellon. Next to Daniel is Jonathan Zuck. Jonathan is president of the Association of Competitive Technologies, and he has a long background in IT as well. Before coming to ACT, he was served as director of technical services at Spectrum Technology Group. Was also founder and president of User Friendly Inc., a Washington, D.C. company providing consulting and software development services, and a number of other IT ventures. So he sort of, like Daniel, has this unique perspective of having a deep IT background and combines it with the policy realm. Finally, joining us through the magic of Skype will be Steve Weinstein, and we'll see Steve in a minute. I think Steve can hear us. Steve is the president and CEO of Movie Labs, which is the film industry's effort to explore and invest in emerging technologies, including anti-piracy technologies. Prior to joining Movie Labs, Steve served as executive vice president and chief strategy and technology officer at MacroVision Corporation. He also, prior to that, was chief technology officer at Vicinity, a mapping company that was acquired by Microsoft and a number of other technology companies. So we're really pleased to have three technical experts that I definitely want to say three because it's certainly not me. But I want to sort of give an overview of this issue. Daniel then will go into the detail of actually what we argue in the paper and what our policy recommendations are. We'll have a few minutes response from Jonathan and Steve, and then we'll have at least hopefully 30 minutes for a discussion from you all, and we'll adjourn precisely at 12:30. So what is piracy? I mean, part of the problem with this debate is that piracy has lots of different definitions and means different things to different people. But part of what piracy really is, is the unauthorized copying or distribution of copywritten content. What does that mean? I mean, there are a lot of gray areas. Is taking a little snippet of a movie and putting it into a college lecture, is that fair use, is it copyright violation? We don't really get into that question here, because I don't think to get into this debate, one has to get into that question. There is a whole non-gray area, in our view, what is purely digital piracy, and that's downloading or uploading whole content of movies, books, videos, music and other files. It could clearly, for one's own use or for one resale, in our view, that's digital piracy. The other, I think, key thing here is a lot of people, I think, in this debate, it's kind of like a lot of these technical debates, they'll argue, well, if this technical solution is not 100% perfect and doesn't completely solve the problem, one shouldn't even bother going about implementing it. And as in every IT area that I can think of, there's no one answer that's going to solve everything 100% perfectly. Rather, what there are an array of tools and techniques, policies, and regimes which collectively put together, we argue, can make a very important dent in reducing digital piracy. The goal should not be eliminating digital piracy. That's simply impossible. There are always going to be people who are engaged in those kinds of illegal activities. But the real goal, and I think the achievable goal, is to have a dramatic reduction of where we are. I'm not going to go through sort of how big this problem is and how much money it costs and jobs and all of that. That's all in the paper. And we've sort of heard it all before. But what I want to talk about a little bit is just why haven't we made very much progress on this issue? Why is it so rampant today all around the world? And I think there's two main reasons for that. One is, making progress in this space requires industry coordination. It requires all the players, including certainly the content industry, the ISPs, but also search engines, credit card companies, ad networks, the whole ecosystem that enables digital piracy to exist requires industry collaboration, and that really hasn't happened, with only a few exceptions, like for example the user-generated content collaboration that where the industry content and the user-generated firms came together to develop a code of best practices. That has worked quite well, but that's really the exception. The second, and I think more important reason why we simply haven't made progress on this, both in the US and in Europe, Asia's a little different, but I'll get to that in a minute, is that there's been this widespread view, really since the 90s, the mid-90s, that I would term cyber-libertarianism. It's this view somehow that the internet is this hands-off zone, it's sort of sacred in its nature. Any government involvement in it is a violation of these core internet principles. So in a lot of ways, this is not just a technocratic debate which we engage in the paper about issues like, does digital fingerprint identification systems slow packet transfer? That's a pretty technocratic issue that's in the part of this debate. We would argue that it doesn't slow packet transfer. It's really a debate about higher level principles, such as, should information be free? Should government be involved and companies be involved in managing the internet for the public interest? Or whether the internet is a self-organizing system that's best left to itself. I think in a lot of ways we can trace some of this thinking, which I think is actually quite dominant both in the US and in Europe, to John Perry Barlow. Not that he invented this, but he certainly maybe had the most cogent statement of this viewpoint. In 96, he issued what he called the Declaration of Independence of Cyberspace, where he said, governments of the industrial world, you weary giants of flesh and steel, I come from cyberspace, the new home of mind. On behalf of the future, I ask you of the past to leave us alone. You are not welcome among us. You have no sovereignty where we gather. Well, when he wrote that, the us was 40 million people. Now the us is 1.7 billion people. So he really doesn't speak for us anymore. He might have spoke for a few people who got on the well back in 85 and were well users, but he doesn't speak for the vast majority of people. The vast majority of people actually believe that the internet is no different than the non-physical world, the non-cyber world, that there are laws, rules, and government and companies and other organizations get to have a debate about what those rules should be. Unfortunately, I think this sort of, if you will, this kind of cyber-free zone, this sort of law-free zone, this sort of free culture movement is quite widespread in the thinking, and that, I would argue, is the core behind why we don't make progress. I was recently reading a statement by a member of the European Parliament, Christian Engström, who stated that commercial file sharing, non-commercial file sharing should be legalized. And what he means by that is I should be able to download any movie on any BitTorrent client I want for free and not have to have any consequences for me as an individual. You say, okay, well, he's just one member of the parliament. Actually, he's a member of the Green Party. But he's in the European Parliament. But it's actually worse than that. Margot Frohlinger, the director of the knowledge-based economy at the European Commission Internal Market and Services Director, so there's a person in the European government, the European Commission government, she agreed with him on this panel. She stated, quote, something has to change. Now, when I hear something has to change, I think, yeah, absolutely, right on, something has to change. We have to prosecute digital piracy. No, she didn't really mean that. She meant something has to change, such as we have to stop worrying about this problem because, she said, quote, privacy will never be completely beaten. So if you can't beat them, join them. Vivian Redding, who was the telecom minister, maybe is for a few more weeks, I don't know when the turnover is going to be, in the EU, she says, quote, growing internet privacy is a vote of no confidence in existing business models and legal solutions. It's a wake-up call for policymakers. Now, I don't know about you, but one of the things I just bought myself for Christmas was a $25 gift card for Amazon eMusic. It seemed like that business model worked pretty well. I went online, I put $25 in, and my son can download music right to his iPod, That seems like that's a business model that works pretty well. So I'm not sure what Vivian Redding is referring to, that there's a no confidence in existing business model. What she's really referring to is we don't want to enforce digital right, digital piracy. In Asia, it's a little different. They just simply have no ideology other than let's take something for not paying for it. Now, there's no real sort of philosophy behind Asian piracy. It's just we can get away with it, so we're going to do it. I think in Europe and America, the policy debate is around this ideology. I'll just close by saying, imagine for a minute if we had this viewpoint or this ideology or this philosophy and it was applied to viruses and other kinds of malware. So in other words, it's important for people to be able to upload and download viruses because that's part of the creative ecosystem of the internet. People need to be free to experiment with these things. And any technical controls on viruses, they simply won't work because they'll slow down the internet, they'll inadvertently interrupt someone else's packets and stop them. So we just simply should leave them alone. We'll just accept that viruses are here and learn to live with them. Now obviously, thank God we don't do that. And we actually do have technical means to stop viruses. No one says, by the way, that viruses are, anybody here would say viruses are gone because we've solved the problem of viruses? No, we clearly haven't solved the problem of viruses, but we don't give up. We don't say we should stop innovating. We don't say the government should ban Symantec and McAfee from developing antivirus programs. We simply say this is a big challenge and we've got to have all sorts of technical, legal, and other steps to fight it. And I think that's exactly where we need to be with digital piracy. So with that, Daniel's going to talk a little bit about some of the findings here and then some of the recommendations. Thank you.
Thanks, Rob. What I want to do is go through three different areas of our report. I want to start with talking about the purpose of anti-piracy efforts and then talk a little bit about the different solutions that we get into to reduce piracy, and then what our specific recommendations are for reducing piracy. And as Rob mentioned, a lot of the debate right now is focused on people saying, advocacy groups saying, if you can't solve it, we should just kind of give up. We should go home and call it a day and say we can't solve this kind of problem. But that's simply not true. Right now, there's a whole host of solutions out there that can have a serious impact on reducing piracy. And the most important thing is, when we're looking at this, we can see a kind of an evolution over the past 20 years where we've come. If you look at this chart, it used to be that getting copies of software, both legally and illegally, was difficult. You know, that was the pre-internet era. If you wanted to copy software, you'd have a lot of diskettes. Storage was relatively expensive. It was hard to do. You also had to go to a store, and that's something that's really difficult, I guess, back then. But then you move to this kind of Napster era, 1999 to 2001, 2002. You really didn't have iTunes back then. iTunes didn't come around until 2003. The only really easy way to get content was illegally. And that's when, you know, the value proposition for piracy really took off. And now, of course, we're up here in this new era where it's much easier. You have Hulu, you have Netflix streaming, you have all these great ways to get content easily, legally, but we haven't done enough to push back on piracy. Piracy is still very easy. It's very easy to do online. So really, when we're talking about these different solutions, the goal is how can we move kind of to this left quadrant where it's still very easy, where it's still very easy to go out and get legal content, but at the same time, you have lots of controls in place, so piracy is much more difficult. So in the report, we look at different categories of anti-piracy solutions. Generally, in three different categories, we look at ones that either have been used, are being used today, or we think could be used in the near future. So this first category is changing social behavior. And this has obviously been tried for quite a while. You might recognize up there, that's from Don't Copy That Floppy, the famous video, MC Double Def DP the rapper, that taught a lot of kids they shouldn't copy software. The marketing campaigns have gotten better. But this is an important part of what industry needs to do over time, because you can change social norms. You can look back at anti-littering campaigns, anti-smoking campaigns. It takes a long time. I mean, that was maybe 40 years, but it is something that you can change over time. And this really works in parallel with providing users legal means of accessing content. So when you have a campaign that says you shouldn't go and download TV programs, then you also go and you create Hulu where you can go and access these content legally and easily. And that seems to work pretty well. And then another aspect that we look at in this is helping users, or users need a lot more help, I think, identifying content that is legal online. What we've seen in the past few years is a shift, and we talk about this a lot in the paper, a shift from just P2P exchange of copyrighted content to now having a lot of websites where people can go onto these websites and stream videos. They can go onto these websites and actually purchase content. And there's not an easy way for users to actually know if these content, if these websites are legitimate or not. And that's a serious problem, because even if you tell users this is what they should be doing, they need to have a way to know that they're actually not engaging in piracy. But a lot of the really interesting work that we've seen over the past few years has been in the technical controls. There's really a whole host of options here. First, you have digital rights management, which is, of course, what's used across the board for many different areas of controlling content. DRM is generally used to control licensing agreements. So it's used to make sure when you buy software, you can only install it on a few computers. It's used to make sure that you can't copy media. It's used to make sure that media can only play on a certain device. And this is generally very effective. You also have network management, and this is something we've really seen in the past year. It used to be that, of course, a lot of ISPs had these all-you-can-eat broadband plans. And this was very common until P2P took off and you had people abusing the system. And now OECD did a recent study where they showed over about a one-year period there's been a switch. So now two-thirds of OECD countries all have ISPs with bid caps. And this has been specifically in reaction to high usage because of P2P. And then content identification is really one of the core technologies that we focus on in this paper. Content identification can be used really anywhere in the internet ecosystem. It can be used on P2P networks, it can be used by the ISP, it can be used on user-generated content, UGC sites like YouTube, and it can even be used in consumer electronics, like a handheld device, an iPod, a TV, a DVD player. And there's three types of technology in general that apply content identification. So you have watermarks, fingerprints, and then the use of metadata. So watermarks, most people are familiar with the visible watermarks that you see on an image, on a photo that's being distributed. But what you have with these digital watermarks are embedded identifiable data that goes into the audio and video that is imperceptible to humans, so you can't see it when it's there, but of course is readily visible to a computer. And these are actually really powerful. Right now, watermarks are being used in the theatrical releases of most movies. So if somebody goes into the theater and they bring a camcorder and they record the entire video, and then they go and they want to distribute it to someone, they upload it onto a file sharing network, the studio can actually look at that video, even though it's just been recorded off a camcorder. That watermark is retained, and they can figure out exactly what theater it came from. There's even some new watermarks that they can tell where in the theater you were probably sitting when you did that recording. So this is really powerful stuff, and it's really it's very strong, it's very robust. It's hard to defeat, even when people crop and scale and transcode the video, it still remains there. And watermarks are also being used in DVDs to help enforce licensing restrictions to prevent copy. And then you have fingerprints. And so the difference between fingerprints and watermarks is when you take identifiable data and you add it to the video, you add it to the audio. A fingerprint just analyzes this media and it comes up with a signature for it. And you can use this signature and compare it to a database, and then you can figure out if this is a legal content, if it's copyrighted content, and whether or not it should be somewhere. So this is what UGC sites like YouTube use to figure out if content is up there on their site that shouldn't be. And then you have metadata. And metadata is kind of a broad category. You have peer-to-peer protocols like BitTorrent that they create hashes, which are basically just unique identifiers for files that you want to download. So this is data that is sent over the network when you want to download a specific file. And so what you can do is you can track these hashes or these unique identifiers and figure out what they correspond to, if they correspond to copyrighted content. And then when you see them flowing across the network, you know that this corresponds to pirated content. And so all of this content identification technology is actually really interesting, because once you do this, once you can identify the copyrighted content, and when you can identify somebody using this, then you have a lot of options. So one option you have is to really kind of do nothing. You can just passively monitor this. And some content owners choose to do this. They want to just collect data. And this can be very powerful, actually, for some users. So they can collect data and see, for example, a band might want to know where their music's very popular. And then they can take that data and decide where they want to do a tour. You can also try and actually stop the transfer. If it's a peer-to-peer transfer, you might be able to stop it. If it's something that's on a UGC site, you can identify the content, take it down, and prevent other people from re-uploading it. You can send users notice and tell them to stop, and this is part of kind of an educational campaign. You want to let users know that what they're doing is not anonymous, that they are being seen when they do these actions, and that also this activity is illegal. Sometimes, of course, you have parents with teenagers that they don't realize what their kids are doing, and so they need to go in and remedy that. And you can also use this to advertise to users. So some content owners don't want to send a letter threatening to sue a user, but they would be happy with sending them a letter saying, hey, our band's in town, maybe you'd like a ticket, or we're selling this promotional material, and they can try and generate revenue that way. But we've seen lots of criticism of content identification technology, and most of it's really unwarranted. The technology is obviously not perfect. No technology is perfect, and it varies by implementation how cost-effective it is and how effective the technology is in general. But there's no reason that with proper safeguards, the technology doesn't work, and that it would not infringe on civil liberties, that privacy rights can't be protected. And more importantly, overall, these technologies can have a serious impact on reducing piracy. The last kind of technical issue that I want to talk about in this area is blocking websites and blocking financial transactions to websites. What we found is looking around, in many cases, piracy is not just about a few friends swapping MP3 files over Instant Messenger or over P2P. Piracy pays. It's a very profitable business. And right now it's being driven by profit-seeking individuals and organizations that are purposely profiting from the unauthorized use of copyrighted content. So why aren't we doing more to stop the websites that knowingly engage in piracy and support piracy? We know which sites these are. It's very easy to find. All these users are obviously finding it. So why don't we do more in this area? And so there's a number of things that we could do. We could have ISPs simply block these websites. It's simple to do. We do blacklisting right now for spam. Most ISPs use that. It's a very simple technology. You can use DNS blacklisting, where if a user tries to query a certain site, they're just redirected to a page that doesn't exist. They could be redirected to the FBI, or they could be redirected to an anti-piracy organization. And certainly, if you implement a blacklist like this, you would want to have safeguards in place to prevent abuses, to make sure that nobody gets up there that shouldn't be up there. But technically, there's no reason why this couldn't be applied. At the same time, you also have to question, if we're going to block sites, or if we think about blocking sites, why do search engines return results with links to all this pirated content? We obviously know one search engine, a company that says, do no evil. And you can question whether or not linking to pirated content meets that motto. Because there's really no reason why, if you have a list of websites that have pirated content, why you couldn't remove those results from the search engine. And that really is one key way that people find pirated content. If they can't find it, they can't download it. Right now, on Google, if you go to a site that has malware on it, you receive a notice that says, this site contains malware, are you sure you want to proceed? You could even do something similar with that, where you still allow the users to go, but you still alert them that what they're doing is either wrong or at least it's not a legitimate site. And finally, when we talk about these sites, these are businesses, or if they're not businesses, they're nonprofit organizations that still need a lot of funds to subsidize the cost of hosting and bandwidth. These especially very popular sites are very expensive to run. And when you look on them, this past weekend I went on the Pirate Bay and ISO Hunt, two of the most popular websites, and I was actually a little surprised who the top advertisers were. You see Amazon on there, you see Blockbuster, you see British Airways, you see Sprint. So you know, you see all these, you see Google AdSense being used on these pirating websites. We really need these companies and ad networks to stand up and say, no, we're not going to engage in this, that this And if we did this, that would really cut off the revenue. And if you can't have that revenue stream, you can't support these sites, and a lot of these sites would come down. And then, of course, you have sites that don't depend on ad revenue, they depend on direct payment from users. And again, in this area, we can work with banks and credit card companies to cut off payments. We've done this before. Obviously, Visa tried to do this with all of mp3.com. It was a Russian site selling mp3s. They had limited success, although the site is shut down now. But there was laws passed, of course, in the United States for this, for online gambling. It was actually relatively effective. We also look at a number of legal solutions. The biggest ones, of course, have been lawsuits against organizations that help facilitate piracy. The Grok's decision was critical in this. It said that, you know, if you're a company that creates software applications that directly leads to the infringement of copyright content, you can be held responsible for the actions of third parties. And then you've seen lawsuits against individuals. This was, of course, done by the recording industry, and they backed off from that. But what they've moved to now is a system of sending notices of copyright infringement to users. And the way this works, and it's being applied in a number of countries, is that the copyright content holder sees something that's illegal, they record an IP address, and they send a notice to the ISP. The ISP then takes that notice and forwards it on to the user. So in that initial action, no personal private information is ever released to the content owner. They can sue for it if they want. But at that stage, the ISP is just passing along the message, and this can be very effective. It can be very effective, especially in providing notice and providing an educational component. But when you look at other countries, you can also see that it's very effective in reducing piracy. This is a graph right here of when Sweden implemented their law this year. It was passed, I think, either last year or the beginning of this year, but it went into effect on April 1st. And you saw a 33% drop in internal traffic because people realized that now, you know, they could be held liable for this, and that eventually content owners could get their information. And then along with this system of notice, of course, is what do you do if people don't respond? So a number of countries have implemented three strikes regimes or something called a graduated response, where penalties go up for repeat infringers. So the first time you might get a notice, if you keep doing it, you might get a bid cap imposed, and it might go significantly further down if you continue to do this, and of course afterwards, if you keep infringing, maybe you would even go up to a suspension of internet service. So as you can see, there's a huge variety of possible controls out there. And then, of course, the question is, what can policymakers do today? What our key argument in this paper is that we need to start a broad dialogue with all the stakeholders on how to improve their global response to piracy. This isn't something that just one country can take on its own. And clearly, not all the solutions are perfect, and some are better than others, but all of the options should be on the table. So our first recommendation is the government needs to do more to support anti-piracy innovations. Some advocacy groups have objected to anti-piracy innovations, saying that in general they should, quote, not be allowed, encouraged, or mandated. And this is really completely wrong. You know, the bumper sticker response would be, if you outlaw innovation, only the outlaws will innovate. And we should really see government doing more to push innovation in this area. FCC can become more involved, they can approve of some of these technologies, they can endorse them, and they should be encouraging them. You can have the National Science Foundation funding more anti-piracy research. The second recommendation that we have in this area is to encourage more coordinated industry action. As Rob talked about, there's a little bit of a prisoner's dilemma here. But the different stakeholders can come together and develop best practices and a self-regulatory regime. We can see this as a potential solution for ISPs implementing a graduated response system. You can see this maybe with ad networks coming together and saying that they won't advertise on websites that engage in piracy. We can also have government, with industry help, identify websites that are engaging in piracy in these organizations and help create this kind of blacklist so they can be applied in these different areas. So the ISPs and search engines can block these websites, so the ad networks can refuse to do business with them, and so the credit card companies and banks can refuse to process their payments. And our last recommendation in this area is to pursue international frameworks to protect intellectual property. Right now, nations with weak laws really provide a safe haven for those that want to engage in piracy. And this has been one of the problems that we've had. What we really need is an international agreement to hold nations responsible for the data flowing out of their networks and for the content hosted within their borders. And this isn't just something that will be important for piracy, although it will have a huge impact there. But this really gets to a lot of the cybersecurity issues we see, spam, viruses, malware, where if countries are held responsible for what is happening inside their borders, they're more likely to take action. And finally, we need to work with international partners. We have a number of agreements already in place. We're developing some more to make sure we have developed a global response to piracy, to make sure we're pressuring nations that aren't getting involved in this fight involved. So I'm going to turn it over to you, Jonathan.
Thank you.
Everybody hear me? I mean, everybody can always hear me anyway without a microphone, but I guess it's about the video. So to paraphrase Corinthians, when I was a child, I copied software. And when I became a programmer, I set aside Copy 2 PC, which was a software at the time that you used to break copy protection on floppy disks for software. I had a very enlightening experience. When I was in college, I got a copy of software from a friend, got the software to break the copy protection and use the software without paying the license. I admit it, right? It's some sort of a pirate anonymous meeting that we should probably hold at some point, and we all have a story to tell. But then I wrote a piece of software, and this is going to predate some of you, but at the time, DOS didn't really come with a lot of printer drivers. There wasn't a lot of ability to print from applications. And so there was this little utility called PrintScreen that allowed you to specifically dump whatever was on the screen to a IBM Pro printer, and that was it. Well, there were, of course, many other printers on the market, but this just supported IBM Pro printers. So I had this idea, and it captured the PrintScreen key, to do that. So I had this idea, well, I'll just create that same little utility, but have it be able to print to Epson and HP printers. And people might be interested in that. So I created the utility, I put it up on CompuServe, and I said, if you like this and you decide you want to use it, send $10. And I received $25. And my utility was downloaded 52,000 times. And so that was kind of a wake-up call, right? That, oh, I spent a significant amount of time on this, right? It turns out that there was really a market for it, but nobody wanted to pay me for it. And it turns out that the only thing that really saved me, I think, was the BSA, actually, at the time, because it found its way into the offices of Merrill Lynch. And I got this call, and they said, what do you want for a site license for a print screen? And so I'm like, $500? And she's like, okay, where do I send the check? And I'm like, per department? Try to rapidly change. And it's because those audits had begun, et cetera, so there were certain organizations that it was actually worthwhile for them to pay a site license rather than risk the liability associated with, just pirating software. And so in some ways I have the BSA to thank for having made any revenue whatsoever. I ended up making, maybe $3,000 or something like that from this utility. A more modern example, there's a software company that writes software for the Macintosh called Ambrosia, one of the most popular shareware companies. Some of the most popular tools that are available, some of them have even been OEM by Apple, et cetera, a very reputable company, 8 employees, et cetera. They performed an experiment surrounding an upgrade of their software. So during a particular upgrade cycle, they decided to perform an audit of the keys for the software that were submitted for upgrade. And in this one-day period, there were 192 requests for upgrade, and 109 of them were illegitimate keys. 109. And some of those were people that were trying to install it on multiple machines, but at least 50% of those were from unique IP addresses. So you have a business where more than half of the people using your software aren't paying for it, right? So now they are devoting employees to going onto sites and trying to determine what versions of their applications are available on these pirated sites. They're trying to monitor, develop technology to filter these keys, et cetera. And, you know, in the end, the best quote from Ambrosia was, if you want me to write this software, somebody has to actually write it. There has to be somebody. Everybody, they need their Merrill Lynch, right? Somebody has to actually pay for the software. And so I think there's a lot of rhetoric in this debate, right? And a lot of very shrill rhetoric, and to some respect from both sides. But it's important to remember that not only are there little guys on the rights holder side of the debate, there are, in fact, big guys on the piracy side. I mean, I've gotten into fireside chats here with a lot of advocates sort of against increased copyright protection, and they even object to the term piracy, right? Because that's so evocative of, you know, swashbuckling, you know, rapists and murderers that are on the high seas, you know, taking over ships, and you're really blowing this out of proportion, even calling it piracy. Well, it's now a source of enormous organized crime, right? So we get into this debate where, well, it's only little guys that copy software, music, and movies, and it's only big guys that create wealthy rights holders. Of course you're going to end up with a skewed debate. And the truth of the matter is, there's a mix of both on both sides, and you need to develop a system that addresses the needs of everyone. I thought that the thing about Google and you mentioning do no evil, right, from Google, I think it's very interesting and apropos this particular debate because there's that famous Edmund Burke quote, right, that all it takes for evil to flourish is for good men to do nothing, right, and sell ads to them, right? And I guess that's, you know, the truth of the matter is it's not enough to not do evil. You need to be a part of the process of preventing it. And I think it's important to take a balanced approach to this, right? I mean, just as when I was a child, I wasn't too rigorous about copyright protection. Many modern industrialized nations, when they were children, were not particularly rigorous about their copyright protection, including this one here. And so we do have legitimate issues to deal with in the developing world, and that's part of the discussion, I think, that has to come into play from the ideological side of this debate, in terms of how to address the needs of the developing world without placing that burden squarely on the shoulders of the rights holders, et cetera, that are trying to create this content. Because at the bottom line, it's industrial policy, right? Yes, it's industrial policy that dates all the way back to the Constitution, but it's basically policy put in place to make sure that this content, this software, this music, these movies, et cetera, are actually created. I mean, a lot of people like to say, well, it just means that they need to find a new business model, which is something that's popular in the context of music. Well, give your music away and you'll make your money on t-shirts and concert tickets. And I was actually at a hearing with Margot Frohlinger, who's actually a pretty strong advocate for intellectual property. And she said, well, I'm really looking forward to the Makeup Artist and Carpenter concert tour, because I think that's going to be a great alternative way for them to make money working on movies. They'll go on tour showing off their makeup artist's skills because they're no longer getting paid by the movie companies that are making films. So that little quip that applies to concerts doesn't really apply to the whole world of copyright owners, right? So I think that we all need to participate, just as the report said. And I mean, in large measure, the report is kind of an updated, more technically savvy version of a lot of the arguments that have been around a long time, and I'm happy to see them come back full circle. I think copyright owners have found themselves hiding in the shadows, you know, that they're somehow bad people because they sue people for stealing their stuff. And that's precisely what they need to be doing, right? And I also want to echo what you said about international agreements as well. If you take a company like Microsoft, China is the number two user of their software. And that yet they fall like number 21 in terms of revenue. Right, that's a pretty big disconnect between usage and payment. And we are in a world in which there's growing interdependencies between countries, and we have the opportunity to leverage those interdependencies to make sure that we create a rule of law internationally. Right? Those countries are no longer developing in the really earliest sense of the term. And in fact, You mentioned the prisoner's dilemma. I think another aspect of that is the degree to which countries enact rule of law policies for intellectual property and innovation within their own borders. They're creating an environment conducive to innovation and entrepreneurship within their own borders. And that's the other thing to also remember. If all you do is build a consumer-based society, you're undermining your own ability to grow and to build an economic system that's based on these intangibles and the exports that allow you to grow beyond the size of your own marketplace. But, I mean, we're not perfect in this ourselves. We have too many silly examples for the Chinese to point to of you know, attempts at subtle debates here and being able to buy, you know, pirated goods across the street from the White House. I mean, you know, these symbols matter, and we need to make sure that our own house is in order, but then take that show on the road, do the concert tour, right, and make sure that around the world that we're enforcing these copyright rights, making sure that our trading partners are doing the same, because fundamentally, you know, we're not a manufacturing economy. We're trying to build these innovations, we're putting out the music people want to listen to, and it's not a blood transfusion. People can decide not to listen to it if they don't want to pay for it, and we need to make sure that if people want this content, that the people creating it have a way to feed their families. So I really support the paper, and thanks for writing it.
Good, thank you, Jonathan. And Steve, I don't know if you can hear us, if you want to make any remarks, or if you want to just sort of hold off until there are questions. Steve, are you there?
There you go. I think you guys can hear me.
Yeah, we can hear you now. Perfect.
I apologize. I for a long time. The Skype line went different a long time ago. But I had some of it on the Ustream. I jumped over to the Ustream. At Movie Lab, you know, we have been working with a lot of these technologies, and I think one of the things that should be pointed out, and I think what was pointed out by Daniel, was that many of these technologies are in use today. I mean, truly in use today and having an effect. I mean, it's not a lot of them, you know, like three, four, you might have said that filtering of content is an impossibility, you know, that it just wasn't accurate to do a good job. But you look at a bunch of the user-generated sites like YouTube and some of these other ones, they are looking at every video and matching it against a large database of, you know, tens of hours of content and making determinations of whether they should allow that video to be up there. I mean, you see in the supply chain that the industry has been using watermarking and forensic tracking to basically stop piracy in the supply chain. In the distribution chain, you know, people have been talking about the watermarking and finding it in the theaters. At the universities, we've been using efforts, you know, from, you know, port blocking, site blocking, you know, universities have been trying to teach and inform their, you know, the students, and have had a lot of success by just teaching that there, you know, that there are alternatives and good ways to get content, and what they're bringing is potentially, you know, illegal. We've seen it, you know, at the torrent sites, you know, efforts with Mininova and some of these other ones on basically looking at content have, you know, resulted in vast changes in Mininova's business. I think across, you know, other places, you know, starting to work with ISPs on graduated response. These are programs that are already in places. You know, France has, you know, has just starting to implement their graduated response. And then we're also starting to work with, you know, equipment and, you know, manufacturers and publishers, you know, to kind of look at, you know, the transfer of content is that, you know, should be treated like malware and viruses and anti-spam. So I think, you know, as there's a lot of technologies, but these technologies are being used today, and they're being used effectively and cost efficiently. So I support of the efforts that ETF has been doing in this area, you know, in the particular paper, and you guys, I hope you could have heard me.
Great, thanks. I think a couple of things. I think one thing that shows is if more people were not downloading P2P files right now, we would have heard Steve a lot more effectively. We've got
or more network management.
Or more bandwidth, or all three. or a better connection in Steve's Hotel. So, comments, questions, if you want to do so, please raise your hand and identify yourself.
Yes, what I'm doing is...
Could you identify yourself, please?
My name is Jessica Wong. I'm a PhD student at George Mason. Yes, I'm doing research on piracy, the software piracy. The question people ask me most is, why don't you just lower the price and make it as cheap as possible, so people will go to buy the legal copy instead of do the piracy, you know? And it's a very simple question, but sometimes it's hard for me to answer. I say, you know, simple, cheap price, how are we going to cover the cost? But this kind of, you produce a digital copy at the industry in a factory, doesn't cost much.
So, well, yeah, I mean, that's a, sorry.
Go ahead.
I guess it's just a report. That's a problem of upfront costs, you know, versus marginal costs, right? So the price of copying a piece of software once it's written is quite low. The price of doing the R&D and the hiring to create the piece of software in the first place is quite high. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I mean, everybody's sitting down with the economics of their software, and what you find, in fact, is that piracy leads to higher prices in software in order to compensate. So you end up with a subsidy effect, and so you'll actually, piracy has a tendency to actually increase the price of software or content, et cetera, to make up for the piracy that takes place.
Yeah, I was just going to add, when you talk about some of these anti-piracy technologies, they actually do help with the pricing. I mean, first you have strategies like Microsoft, which, you know, with the new Windows 7, they had a whole student licensing system. And, you know, they sold it for, you know, $29, Windows 7, that's very cheap. But when you have DRM, you can actually do some really interesting things. You can try and get rid of the economic inefficiencies. So, for example, you could sell software for a limited time period if you want. You can sell it and be more confident that it's not going to be copied. And when you can put these kind of controls, then you actually sell the user exactly what they want, and they can price accordingly.
Well, yeah, and I guess the other point I never want to back away from is that the innovation should be a response to non-use, not to piracy. In other words, if I'm pricing my products too high, that should mean that people aren't using them, not that they're stealing them. And then that lack of use could lead to me lowering my prices to increase usage, legal usage. But I think we get ourselves into a slippery slope when we say that the best response to shoplifting is to make products in stores cheaper. I don't think that that's the best approach to solving a problem of illegal behavior.
Thank you, Patrick Ross with the Copyright Alliance. First of all, thank you, Daniel and Rob, for this paper. It's fantastic. I wanted to pick up on your recommendation on the FCC in particular and come back to what Rob was talking about the perfect is the enemy of the good, that if you have just one particular problem, you shouldn't be using technology. I'm wondering if you're actually going to submit this in the rulemaking process that's going on right now on net neutrality. And also, if you could elaborate a little bit on what the FCC should be told and what specifically they could do to help promote this kind of innovation, since the FCC chairman himself has said that he wants to make a clear distinction between legal and illegal traffic in his regulations.
You want to take the first part?
Yeah, I mean, we are going to be filing something on the NPRM, and this our filing will include something on this.
Yeah, and, you know, specific things that they can do. I think when you start talking about some of these measures, you know, ISPs doing filtering or blocking sites, I mean, these are questions that obviously these companies might be hesitant to do without approval. And so that's when, you know, we talked about in the paper a little bit about how you really need a system in place where proposed ideas or ideas that are in place that they're not sure about, that there can be a good dialogue between the industry and the FCC. Make sure that you know, they iron out the details and that the right protections are in place. And then also, of course, for consumers and other groups, you have an avenue for them to discuss anything that's in place that they have objections to. And that can be like that. Because you do want to avoid a situation where nobody is going to move because they're all afraid of what may happen.
Well, I think in that sense, Patrick, I commend the chairman for making that distinction. But I think that he and the commission need to go further, because there is so much skittishness on the part of ISPs to do anything because they will get whacked within a minute by advocacy groups screaming that they violated the sacred nature of the internet. And there needs to be a clear delineation of there are legitimate things ISPs can and should do to manage their networks, including stopping piracy. That's very different than Madison River. I mean, anybody who would put those two together, I think, is just conflating this for political purposes. Madison River is a very clearly a wrong thing to do. Blocking a website that has been on a blacklist or it's clearly about piracy is clearly a good thing to do. And not just good for the ISP, but good for the consumers of the ISP, and also, as we alluded, good for consumers of the legitimate content because they'll end up paying less for it.
Well, isn't the Comcast case, though, precisely about an allegation that they interfered with BitTorrent, which is used 99% for piracy?
I mean, the Comcast case was about two things. It was about the fact that there was piracy involved, and then it was also about interfering in a particular site. So there's two debates. Some people argue that the use of BitTorrent was irrelevant to that debate. We don't take that position. We think that it's actually quite relevant to the debate and what Comcast did. But secondly, you're right. I mean, here's a case. In our view, what Comcast did wrong was how they rolled it out and how they announced it and the lack of transparency, which they have fixed. I don't think they did anything wrong. If you go up to Canada now, Rogers is doing the exact same thing with the blessing of the Canadian regulator, because cable networks have just limits on upload capability, and they need to be able to do that if they want to give the vast majority of their customers a legitimate service. That's really what Comcast was doing. Now, if Comcast were doing something different that was like, we're going to block all video, because if people are migrating, frankly, away from cable TV or whether it's on Verizon or cable system, migrating over to just getting their stuff off of Hulu. Great, that's wonderful. And if ISPs were to say, no, we're going to block that, that's a Madison River type infringement. But just limiting uploads at congested periods has nothing to do with that and should be completely allowed. And I think the FCC made the wrong decision and set a precedent that's going to deter this kind of active management for the public good. David?
David Stone with the Center for Democracy and Technology. Rob, you characterized some of the concerns about identification technologies as basically being, well, if it can't be perfect, then we shouldn't use it at all. But I do think there are some questions about effectiveness, and I guess it seems to me effectiveness is an important question to ask, especially if there's going to be some costs entailed. And one piece of pushback I've heard a lot when I discuss this amongst audiences that are a little bit technical is, well, wait a minute, aren't a lot of content identification technologies going to be frustrated by encryption? And isn't the trajectory of this pretty clear that you could install some kind of content identification system and it would only be a fairly short while before encryption is being used to defeat it? And at least for, I think folks have said today that a lot of the piracy is actually big players, a lot of big players involved in the game doing it for money. Aren't all of those folks going to be easily able to these technologies?
I want to let Steve and Daniel respond to the technical part, but let me just make it clear what our position is. Let's just say that you have a continuum of zero of accuracy to 100% accuracy, and there's something in between is where the reality is. If we were at 50% accuracy, in other words, 50% of what gets interred and stopped is legal and legitimate, yeah, that would not be an effective system. That wouldn't be working. But we're not at that point. We're somewhere in the 90s. And so you're absolutely right, David. I 100% agree with you. That is the question to ask. But I think at least our research suggests that we're closer to the 90s than we are to the 50s, and therefore suggesting that you're never going to get 100%, or maybe unlikely you'll get 100. So where's the acceptable number? And I think some advocates would say that, oh, the acceptable number is only 100, and some would say, well, even 95 is not good enough. So. Steve, do you want to talk about that particular issue of encryption?
Well, first on the accuracy of matching and recognizing of content. I mean, I think that, like on a peer-to-peer, the whole network works on the idea that you're sharing the same file. And since you're sharing the same file, you really only have to verify it one time. No matter how many times it's been pushed down, because, due to mathematical hashes and stuff like that, you can kind of get a very high confidence level, and that file as well is the original file that was matched. I mean, in terms of other MAC technologies, you know, when you take into account the, you do get into the high 90s, and you also have a confidence level that you can associate with these technologies. So I think the notion of content matching is relatively solved, particularly when you, put some tolerances in there and you err on the side of being correct. In terms of the second issue on encryption and changes in the technology, I agree, there are going to be changes in technologies, and one of the paths down is that people could go to a more encrypted way or an obfuscated way of content. And when this happens, or as it, there are going to be other technologies that might counter this. I mean, for years, the content industry has been fighting, thinking they're putting out great encryption for content, yet constantly being hacked, or frequently being hacked. And I think the reverse is true when the pirates start using these technologies. So I think, having an openness and a freedom to kind of, counter technology with technology is something that's been happening since the beginning of this industry.
Great, thanks.
It's also true of spam and malware and everything else, that same kind of technological arms race takes place in these other technologies as well.
I just wanted to add on, specifically, as we said, there's a couple things. I mean, that objection has been raised for a number of years. And the point is the technology, right now people generally aren't using encrypted streams. That's not what the majority of people are doing, so that's why that's what the solutions are not targeting right now. But even if you start moving in that direction, depending on what you're looking at, you actually can't encrypt kind of everything. If you're doing a peer-to-peer transfer, you are transferring it to somebody, and the other end, they're receiving a decrypted version. So if you download from someone, then you know what they had because you just got it from them. So you can still identify that they had this content. Some streamed, there are ways to do kind of man-in-the-middle attacks, so you can see streamed attacks. And of course, if you're uploading things to UGC sites, you can still use content identification there. So there are a number of issues, where even though you have great encryption, you can't necessarily apply it in a perfect way to detect piracy.
One other thing, I don't know if you can hear me.
Yeah.
Is that, most of the strategies that people are thinking of taking are not, 100% all in or all out. I mean, the goal is really to get people to redirect themselves to, legal uses of content or not doing illegal transfers of content. And that means, 5, 10, 15%, in each one of these technologies is considered, progress and potentially has a halo effect and causes other people to move. So when you think of all these technologies and counter technologies, you got 5 or 10% in some of them that has great value to the ecosystem and bringing revenue and other protections for content.
Okay, thank you. Yes, sir.
Yes, I'm Chuck Flieger. I'm a computer security consultant and I'm also the author of Copyrighted Content, so I have a vested interest in this. And first off, I want to congratulate you both for putting forward what sounds like a very good report and I look forward to reading it. One of the things you call for is attention by the ISPs and the ad providers. I want to press on that for a second because it seems to me it's not in their vested interest to do anything to promote good content sharing. ISPs, being very simple about it, they're interested in customers. And the more customers they get, the more customers they can sell, they're happy. Being cynical about ad providers and ad marketing agencies, they're interested in advertising. The more advertising they can push, the more eyes they can get to see that advertising, the happier they are. So what makes it in their vested interest to promote appropriate use of digital copyrighted material?
Lawsuits.
Well, I think a couple things. One is, I think you have to differentiate ISPs from the other players in the ecosystem. Because the other players in the ecosystem don't benefit from reduction in piracy. ISPs do benefit from reduction in piracy. The loads on their network, the traffic management, the ability for other consumers their broadband services to get better services is clearly better. And so in that sense, ISPs, you can argue, have at least mixed motives. And I think you've seen efforts, certainly in this country. There are some ISPs who do take steps on their own. There are other places in other countries where there have been efforts to do this. On the other side, there, as far as I can tell, maybe I'm wrong, I don't see any benefit from a direct benefit from a credit card company getting less exchange on their credit cards. So I think there what you have to deal with is a couple of things. One is certainly the role of government in pressuring, embarrassing, and raising this issue. You take, for example, the ad networks. Ad networks, one of the major things that they're going to be worrying about in the next few years is regulation. Well, that's a tool. You think about the U.S. government being able to use a quid pro quo and say, one of the things we expect from you as a responsible ad network industry is to be responsible with regard to piracy. And if you do that, we're going to look favorably at some of these other issues. You can see the same thing with regard to search engines and even the same thing with regard to credit cards. Ultimately, it's possible that you need some sort of government action to just simply say this is going to be the rule. But I don't know that we're quite there yet. Seems to me this is one of those things where the ecosystem's evolving and industry collaboration combined with government oratory could lead to some interesting solutions.
I just want to add for the ad networks, there's other types of websites out there where, hate speech websites, there's no reason why, if someone's going to still click on the link to go wherever on this Google AdSense, it still benefits them to sell it. But they do have terms of service. I think what's really interesting, I was looking at the Google AdSense terms of service on what's allowable, where you're allowed to put these ads. And they have about 10 things listed. And of course, the last one is nothing illegal, so that does cover copyright. But everything else before that is, they have very specific things. No pornographic sites, no hate speech sites. They even have no sites that sell student papers. But they don't have no pirate, sites that engage in piracy. So I think part of it is just, having these organizations say, this is what we're not going to do, and make that a priority.
And with that introduction, I'm Kevin Rupi. I'm with U.S. Telecom. And I just want to kind of follow up on that last piece, that last commentary. I certainly agree with everything Rob said. And, I just want to point out that ISPs, obviously this is an important issue to them. They are actively working with the content community. I mean, I think ISPs in particular are very cognizant of the fact that their networks are not going to be of any worth without legitimate legal content. Because ISPs are in, not just the ISP business, they're in the video business, and they want to monetize those networks through legitimate content. I mean, we've spent $70 billion to give consumers access to the content that they want, legitimate content, whether that's through YouTube or other Hulu sites such as that. So I can't, I'll just say that ISPs do want to work with the content community on addressing this problem. There are a lot of legitimate concerns that have been raised in that regard, whether it's cybersecurity, traffic management, etc. We're aware of this problem. It's not, we're not building networks to assist in illegal activity.
I mean, I was going to tell the same, I guess, somewhat cynical story that I find myself telling over and over again, which is that I think the ISPs are going through that same growth phase that everyone else does, which was at a point at which their networks were young, they didn't have heavy traffic on them. The primary reason for people getting faster service was things like music downloads, et cetera, and now they're developing their own content, right? It's the same story. Now I have stuff. Right, and so this is suddenly a much more important problem. I don't say that to malign anyone, but you have priorities in your organization, and now one of those priorities is content, and that changes things philosophically. It's probably also a good time to mention the much aligned, but in retrospect, fairly solid piece of legislation, which is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. which established some rules surrounding this, around circumvention technology prevention technology and rules against circumvention, liability issues, et cetera, that I think have provided a legal framework to encourage the adoption of a enlightened self-interest surrounding some of these issues. I think it's going to take longer for the ad networks, but I think, as Rob says, I think there's going to be incentives to self-regulate before too long, and this could certainly be a key component of that.
Other comments? Yes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Congressional Budget Office. I think the report focuses on the internet piracy, and I'd like to ask whether these techniques are applicable to non-internet-based piracy, in particular transfer of files through external hard drives. For instance, suppose you're 75% effective with these techniques. That means 25% of materials can be downloaded. And if you've got a couple of people in the dorm room, and everybody in the dorm who's got an external hard drive of a terabyte or so, pretty soon you get a transfer of these files to everybody, even though it's not over the internet. So how applicable are these techniques to that type of file transfer? What do you envision as a regime for implementing them to reduce that unauthorized?
Sure. You're right. I'll leave my microphone off. The different technologies address different problems. So, content identification on ISPs obviously will have nothing to do with that. And, if you have a file, there's nothing to ever really prevent you from copying it over to another disk. The question, though, is what else can you do, right? So, one avenue that these anti-piracy measures take is making the creation of pirated content more difficult. So you have better encryption for DVDs. You have watermarks in content, so it can't be copied over into another DVD and then played in a consumer electronics device. You can have these watermarks eventually. The short-term goal is to have these in Blu-ray players and DVD players and maybe on televisions in maybe 5 to 10 years. You will probably have that on your computer at some point. There is the whole initiative of the trusted computing initiative, or trusted computer base. So once you have that kind of system in place, then you do have a lot of controls over every step in the process, and then you can filter out things that are unsigned, and that is one avenue of protecting that. That's kind of a longer-term goal.
I think the other answer to that is the goal here is to, maybe the goal is to get rid of it all, but the reality is we're not going to get rid of all of it, and there's still going to be a teenage kid who buys a CD and burns it onto his thumb drive and gives it to all his friends in high school. That's still a little bit more difficult than just going online and clicking a button. And so what you really want to do on this is, there's a chart in the paper that talks about the goal here is to make piracy hard and legal easy. And when you get to that point, then, there's still people who are piracy's hard and they'll still do it, but a lot fewer people will do it and they'll go to the legal. And that's really the regime I think we need to get to worldwide.
And if we got to a regime where you have to meet everyone with whom you share your digital content, that would be a pretty massive reduction in overall piracy.
Jim?
One issue, too, in many areas, copyright is just so tangled and convoluted that it becomes virtually impossible to sort out in a digital context. Rather, the movie people have done pretty well, I think, at keeping copyright in one hand, but the music people were burned incredibly. Because I remember talking with Mitch Glazer of the record industry one time, and he said that you try to get permission to do digital downloading, and everybody regards it as an opportunity to reopen everything in the negotiation, and you got millions of songs. And so they were utterly disabled. Long ways from doing anything until Napster just forced everybody into it. And you have that same type of issue coming up over and over in a lot of different contexts about the basic nature of copyrights.
Certainly in books now, we see that with e-books, same challenge. Although one would think that people would learn from the music experience and not want to be on that path again of not being able to protect it.
Well, a lot of prisoner's dilemma problems.
Any other thoughts, comments? Yeah, Morgan.
You raised an interesting question right then with the question of e-books. In the recent congressional hearing, one of the advocates for accessibility and we're very supportive of accessibility technologies, commented about the problems that ebook readers were not allowed to have speech to text or have written verbal output. But the reality is there's a large community of people who make money doing that, including a lot of famous actors and others who aren't so famous who do voice readings of books. I'm playing my 3-year-old Danny Kaye albums from the 1960s, where he did you know, Grimm's Fairy Tales. So there's a real value there, and I think that as we look at it, there's this easy notion to decry the inability of somebody to have access to something and not look at the larger ecosystem that it creates. So when looking at the books question and looking at these questions that you just raised about the prisoner's dilemma, et cetera, how do you see in your report, how do we get to the stage where we're encouraging innovation that happens, first level innovation, and not worrying strictly about the piracy stuff? Because we focused, and Jonathan's focused on, how do we prevent piracy, but really what you're after is, how do we encourage innovation? So I guess the last thought I wondered from both of you is, how do you see this tying into the larger question of, okay, we solved piracy, or gotten 90%, how do we make sure that whatever we're doing keeps pushing paid innovation up through the system? And do you guys see those as hand in hand and walking hand in hand? Do you see that the pressure from pirates is pushing a lot of, is forestalling innovation? And is it slowing innovation down? Are people burning FTEs fighting piracy instead of burning FTEs writing cool software, doing voiceovers, doing cool online apps? And did you guys look at that at all?
Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah. Well, certainly we do give some numbers in the report where we look at. Thanks. We do give numbers in the report where we look at how where we look at the impact of piracy on job creation. I mean, there have been a number of studies that look at that, and this is very important. I mean, coming out of a recession, we want to create jobs, and we're talking about mostly American content that is being pirated by mostly people not in the United States. So, you know, there are a lot of jobs involved in that.
I mean, I guess this other part, too, that sort of your initial comment about certain types of DRM or other kinds of technologies might limit certain types of uses. You know, those are all interesting and important debates to have. Sort of where do you draw that line and all that? That's not really what this report's about. Inherently, what this report is about is about the stuff that's much more black and white. Downloading a full video of Lord of the Rings from Pirate Bay. I mean, that's pretty should be pretty clear that, you know, stopping that isn't going to hurt anybody other than the people who are making money on Pirate Bay. So in that sense, I think there's an important debate to have over here about where you draw these lines, et cetera, et cetera. That's an important debate to have. I'm glad we're having it. That's not really what this debate is about. This debate is much more clear cut, much more black and white. It's much easier to solve, and it really is just a question, and we don't have the political will up until now to do this. We simply have decided as a society we're going to turn a blind eye to it, or that's too strong a term, we're not going to do most of what we could do to stop it. And I guess I'm encouraged. I guess today the president is having a meeting with a number of content executives at the White House with Vice President Biden, and that suggests maybe that this administration is going to be a little more activist than the last administration, which to me would be a good thing.
I just want to add on real quick, in terms of, you know, some of this technology actually has some consumer benefits that are traditionally overlooked. So, for example, content identification technology, you know, being able to identify, you know, what you're watching is obviously useful for copyright holders that want to do something about that. But it's also very interesting if, when you're watching something, your TV can know what that is, and, you know, you can build applications off of this. There's some, you know, really interesting opportunities for innovation in that space, and I think you see that with a lot of these technologies where, you know, we talk about, you know, people criticize, you know, some technology innovation, but, you know, peer-to-peer networks, maybe that's bad, maybe we should be innovating in that space because of all the bad things that happen. But you have anti-piracy technology that also has dual purpose. It's good for anti-piracy, but it's also good for lots of other things. And I think you see a lot of innovation coming out of that as well.
Great. Well, with that, I think we will stop. I want to thank Steve from wherever you are in some hotel. Thank you for being with us. Thank you for your comments. And Jonathan, thank you. And Daniel, please join me in thanking him.